Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Actor Tom Vaughan Lawler, good afternoon.
Hello. Hi, Brendan.
And thanks for coming in. So you live in England, but you're over and back to Dublin a lot, are you?
Yes, I lived in England a long time now, but I'm always kind of over and back to Dublin, which is a bit of a head spinner, but it's great. It's great to be home, see my dad, see my sisters and work on a great play.
Yeah, so you're currently in rehearsals for The Weir alongside Brendan Gleeson and others. So it's coming to the Olympia next month, but then moving to London's West End. And we'll come to that. But you've chosen five songs
yes.
that have meant something special to you throughout your life. So let's dive in with the first one. Good Enough by Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah.
Yeah. What does this bring you back to?
It brings me back to watching, I suppose growing up in the 80s, cultural diet. My parents were brilliant at kind of giving us a kind of an international cultural diet, but for better or worse, American pop culture was, the order of the day. But me and my sisters, a shout out to Sheena, Carrie Ellen and Sive. We used to sit on the couch and watch all the great kind of pop American films of the 80s, Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, Stand By Me, all those kind of Dirty Dancing. But the kind of main film was The Goonies.
Right.
And so the song comes from The Goonies, and the placement of the song in the film is total genius. The film is about a group of families who are being evicted by a big tycoon, and the parents are trying to save their homes, but they've got kids who are members of this group called The Goonies. And the Goonies find a treasure map in their attic and decide to go off on this adventure to save their families. But it's interesting when you watch films as a child and you watch films as an adult and stuff you didn't see as a child, and you're like, so where they place the song is where they cross over from being a bunch of kids into a bunch of outlaws. They tie up Josh Brolin and they jump on their bikes and they head off down this hill, and the song kicks in. And this is an amazing moment I'd never seen before. They're flying past the lead character's name is Mikey, and they're flying past his dad's workplace, and he's there lowering the American flag. And he comes out, and it's this kind of beautiful performance by this actor. Just a moment. And he comes out and he's consumed by stress and anxiety and fear about trying to save his family. And they fly past and Mikey goes, "Hi, Dad." And his dad goes, "Oh, hi, Mikey. Hi, boys." He's just so consumed with fear. And he doesn't realize that his son is going off to save him. It's a really stunning moment. And Richard Donner or Spielberg, whoever put it in, it's just class. And her voice is just stunning. It's punky and sassy and joyous and brave. And
you see, you just described a scene from The Goonies there as if you were describing, I don't know, something from Chekhov or Ibsen or something.
Well,
and we tend to think that we grew up in a kind of a cultural desert in the 80s and all that American trash coming in and everything. But actually, you think it kind of formed us in good ways?
Well, I just think when you're talking about filmmakers and storytellers like that, they have all this stuff in there that are kind of, to kids are kind of a bit like, oh, right, there's a double narrative that you don't see. But then when you're an adult, you see all the kind of moments, the beats that you go, oh, like even him lowering the American flag is a statement. And it's just really stunning. And it's very emotional, I think, when you watch films as an adult that you loved it as a kid and you see these other things. Same with like Back to the Future, all those things. They're all dealing with the big themes of family, the passage of time, and they're all brilliant storytellers, and that's why those films endure.
I'm going home to watch The Goonies. Okay, here's Tom Vaughan Lawler's first choice, Good Enough by Cyndi Lauper. That's Good Enough by Cyndi Lauper. That's Tom Vaughan Lawler's first choice today. We were digressing there into John Hughes films, The Karate Kid, everything. A golden era. So that was 1985. That was actually, you first went on the Abbey stage around then, did
That's
you?
That's right. In a production of The Field with Neil Tobin. God, it was around that time.
Yeah.
It was kind of amazing. and Catherine Byrne and John Olihan. So we were, growing up, we were always around actors, around artists.
Your dad was an
actor. My dad's an actor, yeah. So we've always been around creatives. So it's always been in our house. And that's a huge blessing. I think actors are natural anarchists because the life is so nuts. And being around actors, it's just, I just think actors are so funny because the life is so crazy. Whenever you bump into an actor, you have a kind of a shared experience of the madness and the ups and downs. So kind of being around actors as a kid, I always felt comfortable. They were always irreverent, punk and fun. A lot of laughter. And so even in,
your dad, was he a kind of an anarchist in his
own way? I just think an artist in spirit and a liberal and an advocate for political change and an advocate for progressive culture. And so that's the gift both my parents gave me moving into the arts, humanity and learning about the world and
tolerance. The variability of
oh, God. Well, that's, I think, why being an actor is so funny and meeting actors. You have the shared knowledge of, you're all hanging on by fingernails.
And I presume in those days, even more
Oh, totally. But the thing about actors and acting is that, we're all making it up as we go along. I mean, we're doing that in life anyway, but I think it's such a kind of a bonkers industry. I won't name the person, but I've got a friend who's a very well-known actor in England, and he's like, yeah, it's great, you get a job, that's great, yeah. Then you got to get another job.
Yeah.
And then you got to get another job. And then you got to get another job.
So you never get there, no? The way people in their careers, they go,
yeah,
I've made it, now I can kind of relax. Like, you're starting, climb the mountain every
totally.
Time.
But I think it's over if you think you've made it. And I think when you look at all the top actors in the world, they just start again. They start again. Every job is start again, start again, start again. You don't get to that level
of phoning it in.
Well, you don't. I just don't think those top drawer actors, they're like proper world-class athletes. Their commitment, their discipline is unparalleled. Their appetite, their work ethic is ferocious.
You see, that's the thing. Several actors have said it to me in here that you need to be, like, we think of you as poetic souls and kind of fae people and all that.
Yeah.
You need to be tough as nails,
Oh my God, just to deal with the rejection and the kicks and the ups and the downs and just physically, psychologically, emotionally, to sustain a career, because an actor doesn't really retire. I think they're always available. They're always ringing the rage and going, I'm available for work, There's a great nobility in it. And because it's kind of bonkers, I think it's very moving. I find it very, very... Claude Rains, brilliant actor, double Oscar winner. He was in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, an amazing, amazing actor. He died and his daughter said, well, he died like most actors, waiting for his agent to call. And it's an incredibly disenfranchising career, but it's glorious. I think.
Okay, but you have to actually go with the chaos and accept you can't control
You have to,
things,
and you have to. And I remember working with John Leguizamo, who's an amazing American actor, and he really looked, this is years ago, and he was so looking after himself. I said, you really look after yourself. And he goes, well, no one else is going to do it. And this is my job and this is my work and I have to stay fit and healthy. So it was really inspiring.
Yeah, because that was the tool of his work as well,
absolutely,
of course.
Yeah.
So do you have to look after yourself very well?
Well, I try to. I channel all my addictions into chocolate. So that's my big weakness. So that's my big vice. So and my weakness. But you have to try as hard as you can. It's not easy. And I'm very fortunate in terms of my career, in terms of what I've been allowed to do, what I've been given to do, what I've experienced. So, I think the onus is on you when you're given opportunity and a chance to make the most of it.
Yeah.
But
you're riding your luck as well.
I think you have to you go where the work is, you hope for the best, you keep committing to what you're doing and everything else is just so up in the air that you just got to hope for the best.
What an extraordinary description of an extraordinary way to live. Okay, let's get back to music. Your second choice, another kind of unusual one, Johnny Mathis's Feet by American Music Club.
Yeah, I when mid-90s, 93, 94, No Disco came on, Donald Deneen's show, and they kind of had it on Network 2 on a Thursday evening, kind of shunted onto a late night place. And it felt like, I could be wrong, but it felt like very a kind of a secret, because it, no one really spoke about it too much, but it was all alternative music, art rock from America and from the UK and from Ireland, interviews, but mostly often music videos. And the first one, or the one that really hit me, was Mark Eitzel's band, American Music Club, and Johnny Mathis's feet. And I just think his voice is amazing. And the album Mercury is incredible. And yeah, it's amazing.
Okay, let's have a listen. Johnny Mathis's feet by American Music Club. If we're on the right track, but you're a lamb jumping for the night. It's a real showman. Okay, that's American Music Club, Johnny Mathis's feet, and that's actor Tom Vaughan Lawler's second choice today. So I'm kind of getting now, like, you're not your average bear, like, and even these choices, you're going your own way. But then, so you went to Trinity,
yeah.
But you went off to RADA then, which seems like a kind of a very formal choice to make to become a classically trained actor and everything.
Yeah, I knew I needed to be trained. I wanted to have a formal training, and that works for some actors and it doesn't work for other actors. And some people come out of drama school, you know, formed in a certain way, and others don't. It's quite a tricky, it's a very tough, I don't know what it's like now, but when I was there like 25 years ago, it was pretty tough. And then, but then you always hear stories of like drama school in the 70s, and it was just like really, really tough, like proper mad stuff.
Like?
Well, famously, the drama center was christened the trauma center, because you're doing like, but Michael Fassbender went there, like amazing graduates, like an amazing, but it was like
said it was like the Marines.
Yeah, it was totally. Someone asked me, you know, because it was like this, oh, it's RADA, and would they, you know, is it quite fancy? And it's like, the teachers just wouldn't put up with us. They were brutal.
So they kind of break you down? Yeah,
that's the thing. But they do. It's terrifying, because they strip you away of all your tricks and all your kind of affectations, and try and get down to the truth of who you are and what you are. And
okay, and none of us want that. Like,
well, that's the thing. It's like then you get out.
So
and you're
all your layers of delusion and bull that you have about yourself all gets thrown away,
and then you become a professional and you put them all back on. Use all the tricks you can just to survive. But it's really scary, and every day you're kind of made to get up and do everything, and you fall on your face, and you're doing it in front of your peers and your friends, and it's a real thing to come through. And even people who didn't go on to be actors, I think, find it kind of a rite of passage. And so they train you to be thoroughbreds, and they train you to be proper pros, and you've got to work your bum off. And it was amazing. It was really tough and very frightening. And I remember having the runs for the first like few months so badly from the anxiety of it all, because you just don't know what they're
doing. You're scared going in every day.
Terrifying. Like. I mean, just terrifying. Because they just tearing you apart, because they're just trying to get rid of all the kind of affectations and the, you know, bullshit, really.
Okay, yeah. And then when you get out of there, do you get the reward then of, like, if you've gone to RADA, is it easier to start working
not
for
really.
You? Were you waiting tables and stuff?
Oh, yeah. I did everything. Building sites, hotels, coffee shops, secretarial work, furniture removal, everything, gardening. But you meet the most amazing people who teach you like amazing, amazing lessons. I remember I was at this time 20 years ago, I was working in a hotel in Euston, on the Euston Road. And I was grumbling about not having an acting job. And there was a woman there who was from Ethiopia, who had two kids, 6 and 4. She hadn't seen her kids for 2 years. We were getting paid after tax like £200 a week. She was in shared accommodation. She was sending home 50% of her wages every week to her family. And she was amazing. She was fun and light and like really hardworking. And I was kind of moping around. Oh, I don't have a job. Why won't anyone give me an acting job? And she's like, oh, you know, I'm just, you know, doing my thing. So you
get to live a bit.
You get to meet amazing people with amazing stories. And that's just, in a way, I'm so grateful for that, all that kind of non-acting work, because it was just like you're living and you're seeing the world and you're meeting incredible people. You know.
So your next song brings us to, speaking of meeting incredible people, your wife Claire, how did you meet?
We met on a play in Manchester in the Royal Exchange in 2007. And the song is from a musical.
Tell me first about meeting her. In my limited experience of these things, when you meet people in a play, can you sometimes think like,
that's the show here, romance. Totally the show romance. It's a very archetypal thing.
Explain how that works.
Well, I think you are you're recreating emotion in a imaginary circumstances, but you're trying to bring them about truthfully, and so it's very hard. Those things can be mixed with, you know, what's real and what's not, and what's fantasy and what's, you know, the truth. So invariably people, you know, have flings and fall in love and have, you know, whatever. It's just a mad time. You know, it's monkeys. Yeah. I mean, also you're very young and trying to figure out who you are. But so when I met Claire, I was very afraid that it wasn't going to be something, because I knew I really, you know, was very drawn to her. But the song is from A Little Night Music. The song is called The Glamorous Life. And it's from a Stephen Sondheim musical called Little Night Music. And this song is, or the musical is about Desiree, who's this actress. And she's trying to kind of balance her life and figure her life out and balance her home life and her career and her emotional life. And the song is ironic. The title is ironic, The Glamorous Life. It's the idea that an acting life is a glamorous one. The song is a trio between Desiree, the actress, Madame Armfeld, her mother, and Frederica, her daughter. Sondheim was a stone cold genius, an absolute genius. And so in the song, Desiree is kind of jaded by her life and she's singing about this glamorous life. But Sondheim keeps bringing in her daughter's voice because her daughter sees the potential for life, humanity, joy, the possibility of the future. And he just keeps bringing her in. It's just stunning. And
you wanted a very particular version.
Yeah, so this is the 1996 cast recording of the production that was done in the National in London on the Olivier stage. Desiree was played by Judi Dench. Madame Armfeld was played by Sian Phillips. And Frederica was played by Claire Cox, who's my wife. And all of the joy and the humanity and the possibility and beauty and elegance of the character is true of Claire as a person too. So when I listen to it, I hear Frederica and Claire.
Okay. A Glamorous Life from Sondheim's A Little Night Music, and this is featuring Tom's wife, Claire Cox.
Ordinary mothers lead ordinary lives. Keep the house and sweep the parlour, mend the clothes and tend the children. Ordinary mothers like ordinary wives.
That was Tom's wife, Claire Cox, singing The Glamorous Life from Sondheim's A Little Night Music.
Yeah, it's an incredible musical. But the famous number from that musical is Send in the Clowns. It's quite a stunning song. But it's also quite strange in terms of what the meaning of the song. It's quite elusive and abstract. And Frank Sinatra made it very famous. And They said to him, well, what's it about? You know, what do you think it's about? And he's like, oh, yeah, it's very simple. Yeah. You get with a girl, you lose a girl, send in the clowns. everyone's tying themselves up in knots about the meaning of the song. Snatcher goes, look, it's really easy. It's about women.
Yeah, yeah.
So, it's amazing.
That's the great communicator who can cut to the chase, isn't it? Yeah. So listen, two actors in the family. I imagine not a glamorous life. Like, do you miss out a lot on, and you have kids?
Yeah, two kids, yeah.
So do you miss out on a lot of regular stuff?
You juggle, and, you know, a couple of years ago, we were once for a while in three different time zones. I was in America, Claire was doing a TV show in Budapest, and our son was being minded by family in England. So it's a continual juggling act. And, you know, you need a certain amount of money to be able to be able to have an entourage of, you know, tutors and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of like, you hold that child, I'll do this, you hang on there, I'll drop her off, you pick him up, I'll run and do the show. And so it's quite, it's heady. And so, it's crazy, but it's full on. And my kids have been on film sets and backstage in theatres, and I think they get a kick out of it. I hope they get a kick out of it. But my son Freddie has been...
Wait till they go to therapy now in 20 years.
Well, exactly.
And
then well, exactly.
But now you're telling yourself they're having a magical childhood.
I'm telling them they're enjoying it. You better enjoy this. But Freddie's been to see some of my shows and he's like very brutally critical in a good way.
Excellent.
And I like straight through to him, I'm like, oh God, Freddie. He's very funny. It's great. You know, it's full on, but it's fun.
Come here, there's a nice text here from Celine Lenehan. I was working as a speech and language coach with adolescents in difficult circumstances when Tom was in Love Hate. I managed to contact him, asked him would he come and visit the kids. He did twice, as did his lovely wife and other members of the cast. This was at the height of his fame in Ireland when there were so many calls on his time, but he chose to make time to visit the kids, no publicity involved. I treasure the memory of those visits when he brought joy and excitement to the young people and they could forget their troubles for the day. So look, whatever about looking after your own children, you do what you can for the other children. Was that a mad time?
It was mad. Yeah, it was wonderful, but it was kind of, it was wonderful. I was lucky in the sense that we would film and then I would go home to England. And so I wasn't kind of in the eye of the storm.
Yeah.
But even when I say a storm, it wasn't, it was just the appetite for it was so intense that it was sometimes hard to walk down the street. But the thing about that is I cannot remember a single interaction that wasn't positive or no one being, just people wanting to chat and say hello and ask questions and have theories. And it was amazing.
Yeah, it was one of the last great moments of the monoculture in a way. Like that was nothing to do with the internet or anything.
Oh,
it was actually
totally.
Like the late in the 70s or something, the whole country sat down.
Exactly, but the filming of it was wild. Like it was totally wild. And that's what, it was like stuff we were, I was like, how did we do that? And how did we do that? Because there wasn't like loads of money. It wasn't a huge financial huge budget of a show, and so a lot of it was kind of on the fly and kind of running around doing, like, you know, and so I think that added to the energy of the show. So it was an amazing time, and the people, all the actors we worked together, share something very deep, and whenever I see them we just fall around the place laughing because it was just so much fun.
Brilliant. Okay, so back down to earth now, your fourth musical choice today is the Tulla Cayley Band and the Siege of Enniskillen.
Yes.
Why this?
Well, Claire and I got married in the Irish Cultural Centre in Hammersmith, and last year we had a huge bash in the Irish Centre in Camden. On both occasions we had Cayley bands, four-piece and a caller. And I'd say the ratio of, like, it was like 25% Irish, 75% English. And they would go mad for the Cayley dancing because it's communal. You don't have to be good at it. It's fun. You get to dance with everyone. And there's no requirement about looking cool. You all are just kind of... But it was so incredible.
And can you do a good Siege of Enniskillen?
I could do the Walls of Limerick. I could do, a few of those ones. Okay. But I went to Cláiste de Lurgan in Connemara in the 90s, like 4 years running. It was like one of the happiest times of my life. Just glorious. Cayley's every night, falling in love. You know, it's just amazing summers. And then I get quite homesick. Like every now and again, I get a bit homesick. Like it kind of sideswipes you out of nowhere. And when that happens, I'm like, right, we're listening to Luke Kelly. Everyone sit down. Don't say anything. And my family are very sensitive and kind of, you know, indulge my...
Okay. My dad needs to be Irish
dad
for
needs
10
to be
minutes.
Irish. Let him be Irish. And he's like, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I think it's just... When I do get that, I put this on the stereo and me and my daughter dance around the living room and she howls with laughter and I howl with laughter.
Ah, stop. Yeah. Okay.
It's great. That's amazing.
Bring it all back home. Yeah, yeah, so the Siege of Enniskillen, this is the Tulla Cayley Band. The Siege of Ennis by the Tullagh Cayley Band, and you have to picture there Tom Vaughan Lawler and his daughter dancing around on the Kent coast in England.
Yeah, exactly.
I presume there's brooms and everything.
There's a lot going on. It's very funny.
So listen, the play then, Conor McPherson's the Weir.
Yeah.
And you were saying you're deep in rehearsals now. Yeah. You said it's scary every time.
Yeah, it's scary. I just as kind of opening gets closer, you're like, oh, you've actually got to get up and do this. Sometimes you're larking around in rehearsals, go, guys, we've got to focus. You know, they're selling tickets for this. So I think the thing about it is you can get a great cast together and a great creative team, but unless you're doing the rigorous, detailed forensic work in the rehearsal room, you know, it's not enough to have great people there.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing. And we have Conor, who's never directed this play before, his first kind of big, massive hit. He's never directed it before. So this is his first time directing it. He directs all his stuff.
Oh, okay.
So this is the first time him directing it. And so it's kind of extraordinary being with him in the room, and him also treat like he's not reverential towards his own text in terms of there's additions and changes, and so it's a living thing. It's not a recreation of some kind of dusty old classic. It's a great play that he's working on, and our responsibility as a company is to make sure we're hitting all the notes and playing all the right colours and deepening it and making sure we're investigating it every performance.
See, I think even to watch, it's quite an intense play. I think particularly if you're a man, actually. Is it intense then? Are you all in an intense space when you're rehearsing? Are actors like, are you gregarious and having laughing there? Are you in on yourselves?
No. I think,
how does it work?
Well, different actors are different ways. And I think, not to be kind of specifically Irish about it, but I think Irish rehearsal rooms have a very healthy irreverence. That being said, I remember when I first came from RADA to work in Ireland in theatre, I was doing a warm-up, and one of the actors said to one of the older actors, Marlon Brando over here. I was like, I'm just doing a warm-up. I was like, you know. So there's a healthy irreverence, but the work we're doing, I feel, is it's got everything. It's rigorous and it's detailed and it's focused, but also it's fun, because if it's not fun, there's no point. Yeah. And also, if you're not enjoying it, it's like anything, isn't it? If you're not enjoying it to a certain degree, the audience won't enjoy it. And if you're in on yourself and locked in emotionally in a very bound way, they're going to turn off.
Okay.
You
have to be able to hold yourself in it, obviously, but you also are part of an ensemble.
Well totally. You've a the play is number one. And your job is to be true to your character within that ensemble and do justice to the play. Shakespeare said the play is the thing. And
will
you
all become unnaturally close over the next 4 months now in a kind of a weird way? Yeah.
Or we all fall out. Who knows? Yeah. Okay. We all are, you know. But they're great.
So I'd say if it gets toxic and you know there's another 2 months to go, that must be a nightmare.
Oh, listen, it happens in so many productions, but the thing about this,
people, I wouldn't have thought actors would be ones for drama.
Oh yeah, exactly. I know a friend was in a production of Antony and Cleopatra where both Antony and Cleopatra just despised each other. They're supposed to be in love on stage. It was a total disaster. But what's great about this is, like, Brendan is so generous as an actor. He's very humble, you know. Sean McGinley, the same. The experience.
They've nothing to prove either.
They're generous and they're open and they're proper artists and proper actors. They're musicians. They're artists. So all that kind of stuff around this is, you know, they're boring down into the work. And so being on stage with them and with Kate and with Owen is a real honour. And Conor in the corner shaping us and moulding us is really incredible. And it's joy to be in rehearsal.
Yeah. I feel you're a person who, whatever situation you're thrown into, you seem to see the magic and the joy in it. Last song is Nina Simone. Why this?
I think, being an actor, watching artists, listening to artists, and artists who are brave and artists who are emotionally kind of almost reckless with their souls, I find staggering and inspiring. And Nina Simone, her voice is just, I think, is kind of unparalleled in her bravery and in her her expression of who she was is just astonishing. And this song is I Love You Porgy, which is problematic culturally in terms of racial stereotypes now, albeit Maya Angelou was a huge champion of the song. But it's a woman who is in an abusive relationship, who is pleading with Porgy to kind of save her from this abusive lover. And all of the pain and the vulnerability is all there in her voice, and I find it inspiring, and in her piano playing. And I just find her fearless artistry inspiring and also scary, because as an actor, sometimes you're asked to go to places emotionally, and it's scary because you think, what if I can't get there? What if I let people down? What if I can't make it? Or if I do get there, what happens then? But I find her bravery in her emotional recall and her emotional display, I find mind-blowing.
Okay. Conor McPherson's The Weir, presenter by Landmark Productions and Kate Horton Productions, comes to Dublin's Olympia Theatre from August 8th to September 6th, before moving on to the Harold Pinter Theatre in London for a three-month run from September 12th. Tom Vaughan Lawler, that was so generous and absolutely top quality stuff. That was excellent. Thank you so much. And we'll finish on your fifth and final song today, I Loved You Porgy by Nina Simone.
If you can keep me, I want to stay here with you forever.